The Committee of the Higher Education Workforce Development will be in order. Today's date is Tuesday, February 3rd. And thank you, members who are here. Apparently, there's a conflict with, We heard there's a conflict with bonding. There's a joint House Senate committee going on, but we are going to be hearing some reports that, again, were required as of our last legislative session, so I'm really pleased. I think, in particular, you'll see that the Office of Higher Ed has done just an outstanding job on preparing these reports. So with that, I would ask them to come forward. Ms. Fergus, Merritt.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Maren Gelly Henderson. I'm the Legislative Liaison for the Office of Higher Education.
And I am Meredith Fergus, Manager of Financial Aid Research for the Office of Higher Education.
And as Senator Bonoff mentioned, we will be going through a series of reports that are included. Before we begin, I wanted to point out that we have put in your materials a brief on tuition reciprocity. This was in response to the number of questions we received last Thursday. The full report on tuition reciprocity is not yet complete. It will be available by the end of the month. We're waiting for a few more pieces of data to go into that report. But we wanted you to have the brief at this point just to help answer some of those questions.
Thank you very much. Yeah. There were a lot of committee questions.
Also in your packets, you will find a lot of paper. So I just wanted to point to sort of guide our conversation today. We will begin with Meredith giving an update on SLEDs, and with that, there's an infographic. You will also find a report on student loan refinancing, a report on study abroad health and safety regulation, and a report on retention and completion. So we'll start with SLEDs.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. SLEDs is Minnesota's statewide longitudinal education data system. We actually started back in 2006 making some legislative changes that allowed data from K-12 and higher education to be shared within the state. The vision of SLEDs is to serve as a tool to identify the most viable pathways for individuals in achieving successful outcomes in education and work. In order to inform state policy and practice, we are really building our research around four key areas. The first is pathways, the movement of individuals between K-12 higher education and work. Progress, the benchmarks or transition points students meet or fail to meet. Predictors, the characteristic patterns or commonalities that help explain how individuals achieve successful outcomes. And performance, how well our education and workforce align for individual success. That's kind of the guiding principles we're operating under. SLEDs actually launched, we talked a lot about it before, but SLEDs actually launched last April and May. So in April, you received Getting Prepared 2014, which is the legislatively mandated report on developmental education among recent high school graduates. We used SLED's data for that report and replaced an existing data sharing that was with MinSCU and the U. The new report is more comprehensive. We now include students who attend private colleges within the state of Minnesota, but we can also include all the student demographics. So we can tell you which of the students needing developmental education, what their race ethnicity was, what their gender is, what high schools they attended, what language they speak at home, are they free and reduced price lunch. So it really opened up the world of possibilities for understanding which students are enrolling in developmental education after high school. The second tool, which DEED launched at the end of May, beginning of June, is called the Graduate Employment Outcomes Tool. And I wish I had time to kind of show you that one today as well, because it's really cool. What it does is it tells you, for students who graduate from a Minnesota college, be it public or private, are they working 12 months after graduation? What their median wages are? Are they working full-time year-round? We then follow the same students out at the two-year mark, the four-year mark. And we go back to the graduates of 2007. So it's really some cool. We'll also look at what industries they're working in. And I know with this new data set, which combines education and workforce data, we can do a lot more analysis on the alignment of education and work. The third product is the one that I'm going to start talking about today, which is called SLEDs Mobile Analytics. If you have a smartphone, a tablet, or a laptop with you, you can follow along. You go to sleds.mn.gov. The reports on SLEDs focus on, and this is our, oh, we love this. This is our homepage.
Excuse me, Ms. Fergus, could you say it again? SLEDs?
SLEDS, S-L-E-D-S, dot M-N, dot gov. Yes. And it's not slanted when you look at it on screen. So we're just going to go with the flow today. So what you'll get is the SLEDS homepage, which kind of goes over the information that I just talked about. The current SLEDS partners are the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the Minnesota Department of Education, and the Office of Higher Education. If you have questions about the website, you see our contact information is up front and center. We actually encourage questions because, number one, they help provide us critical feedback on the data we're displaying. Two, they help us design new reports to meet your needs. And so we're very excited. The report pane, which is listed here on the left, gives you the research tab, which includes the background of the project. It includes all documentation on what data we collect. It also includes access to research and resources from other states. Approximately 48 other states in the United States are also building a SLED system. Though I do want to brag that we're farther along. In addition, you also have data governance. As you know, SLEDS is managed by the Minnesota P20 Education Partnership. And so we work in conjunction with that body, which includes legislative members, parent-teacher organizations, as well as schools, districts, and colleges, as well as business partners, to help inform and kind of guide the longitudinal data system. So the first report we'd like to talk about is just college enrollment. And the interesting thing is when Rachel, Kara, and I go out to schools, districts, or parent groups and talk about the SLED system, the first question we like to ask is, do we really know how many public high school students go to college in Minnesota? And the interesting thing is, we typically say that about 70% of Minnesota students go on to college. In reality, that's the percentage of students who go on to college in the fall. With SLEDS, we're able to follow those students out to age 25, and we now know that 86% of Minnesota public high school graduates will enter higher education by age 25. 86%. And so it allows us a kind of a more robust picture of what's going on. We are one of the leaders in college participation across the country. In addition, the fun part about SLEDS is we can actually look at this for an individual high school. So, Madam Chair, I was hoping that you would volunteer a high school in your district.
Okay, I'll pick the one that my kids went to, Hopkins High School.
All right. So all you do is type in Hopkins, and you'll come up. The reports automatically load. You'll see here that you can choose what graduation class you'd like to look at. We have data loaded from 2007 forward. We'll stick with the class of 2013. You can choose the race or ethnicity you'd like to see, gender, or the special populations. You can look at English language learners, special ed students, or free and reduced price lunch students. You can also choose any combination of these characteristics. So to give you a bigger scope of what's in SLEDS, if you were to do every possible combination of the filtering we've included in the system, you could produce 17,000 reports.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not something you can do with Excel. It's really much bigger than that. So we're going to look at the class of 2013 from Hopkins Senior High. And what you see is you'll see three bars. You'll see the statewide averages. The green means out-of-state enrollment. The blue is in-state. You'll see the Hopkins School District averages and Hopkins Senior High. So what it shows here is for Hopkins Senior High, your college participation rate is much higher than the statewide average. You're at 81% for the class of 2013 compared to 69% statewide.
Wow. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why would the number for the district be different than the number for the high school, particularly if there's only one high school in the district?
Well, we are... It shouldn't be if there's only one high school, Senator Pratt. We are including all alternative schools. We're also including charter schools, though those typically aren't in the district numbers. They're on their own. But, yeah, we would include all forms of high school within that district. So,
And is it based on student residency or is it based on attendance? So, for instance, we have some kids that will go to Holy Angels.
Madam Chair, Senator Brett, it's based on the school that's attended. So if they are attending in district, then they are caught. If they are going through open enrollment to another district, they're included in that high school's count.
Great. Thank you.
Yep. We do have the possibility in SLEDS of looking at the residency versus the school attended, but we haven't really explored to what that would show in our data. But it is a variable that is collected, resident district versus attending district. We also included in the college, a simple college enrollment, where do high school, and I should say, you can do cool things. You can click off the buttons. So if you don't want to see the out-of-state, you can remove them. You can add them back. You can take a picture. You can click on the eye bubbles for more information. You can send the email link in an email, and whoever receives it will also see what you see.
Ms. Fergus, who designed this?
It was actually designed by Minute staff, and it started at the Department of Education. We used their school report card platform and kind of took it and ran with it. We've done a few more things than they have, but it really was a great platform for us to kind of just be creative and jump off.
So interactive.
Correct. And it's actually our mobile analytics tool that is getting national attention for the SLDS systems. We are one of the few states where it's highly user interactive.
Yep.
You can also add up to 6 schools at a time. So if we wanted to compare Hopkins, the class of 2012, to the class of 2013, we could add them here. So you can see a time trend. Whoops, scrolling a little too fast. We also have where high school graduates go to college, so that will tell you if it's a public 2-year, public 4-year, private 2-year, 4-year, out of state. We also include the top 10 colleges attended. And this is always interesting for high school audiences, because most of the times when I ask the question of what is the number one factor that determines where a student goes to college, most of them answer finances. Based on the top 10 list, we would have to say it's largely location-based. Most high school students are going to attend a college within 100 miles of their home. And, of course, if you're in the metro area, that gives you, 27 options? But for students in greater Minnesota, that location and geographic presence of the institution is highly determinant of where they choose to go to college. So for Hopkins, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities ranks at the highest on the list. They are the largest draw for public high school graduates in Minnesota, enrolling about 5% of graduates annually. Normandale, of course, appears on the list, UMD and MCTC. You do see we do pick up out-of-state schools, University of Wisconsin, Madison, University of Wisconsin, Stout, also appear on the Hopkins top 10 list. The last pane under enrollment is the credits taken in first term of college. As you know, most research indicates that among traditional age students, full-time enrollment is a strong predictor of college completion. The good thing you'll know is if you look at the purple and green bars, 67% of students at Hopkins Senior High are enrolled in 15 or more credits in the fall term. That is the state definition of full-time. If you include the additional 22% who are enrolled for 12 or more credits, which is the federal definition, 99% of Hopkins Senior High graduates enrolling in fall are full-time. Statewide, the number is fairly comparable. You have 67% statewide at the 15 credit level and 24% at the 12 to 14 credit level, which is approximately 91% of high school graduates. We are a strong college-going state. I don't know if there's any other message we can glean from the data.
Well, Ms. Fergus, perhaps another message is that if we can get students to go right after high school, the chances of them going full-time and then graduating on time probably increase compared to if they go a couple years later, is my guess.
Correct, Madam Chair. We like to say get in, get out, because life will bring you other things. So college is one of the things that drawing it out does allow for those things to occur. We also look at the number of students who are completing college. So if you change the pane, we're now at, it still shows Hopkins Senior High. Because we want to pick up college completion, I'm going to change your graduating class to the class of 2008, because they've been in college 6 years now. So if we look for the class of 2008, the first thing you see is the percentage of students who are still enrolled in college after 12 months. And that is enrolled or having completed their degree or certificate. Both of those are successful outcomes. So what you see here for Hopkins, 92% of students made the transition from first to second year, 85% from second to third, and 79% from third to fourth. So what that says is they're making they're staying in school as they move through, or they're finishing successfully. And it's an early predictor of what your college completion rate is going to be. You can see there's a distinctive difference between the statewide average at year four compared to the Hopkins average. It's about 63 versus 79%. So then we look at degree completion. Madam Chair, do you know how many Hopkins graduates completed college?
No, I do not.
So the first thing we're going to look at is just the percentage of students who complete a degree. So for the class of 2008, 57% of Hopkins Senior High graduates had completed a certificate, diploma, or degree, which is shown in this third column at the top number here, 57%. Of those, 52% were at least an associate degree or higher. So 52% of Hopkins graduates were degreed by age 25, or rather in this case, the 6 years after high school. They still have two more to reach age 25. 47% of them had attained a bachelor's degree. So a high percentage of those are bachelor's degree students. Comparatively statewide, it's 48% had completed a certificate or degree, and that's typically what we find across the classes, is about half of high school graduates complete a certificate, diploma, or degree by age 25. 42% an AA or BA, 32% a BA. In terms of just measuring the time to college completion starting at high school graduation, what we see here is that 37% of your students had finished their degree or certificate in 4 years, the 4 years after high school. An additional 20%, though, came in years 5 and 6, which is a significant number. We do have another pane which tracks this out to 8 years, so that you'll see that for earlier classes. So that's kind of the completing college. We are considering expansions, which would talk about the types of degree they receive, the majors. We're also doing probably some college reporting, so entering student profiles, college mobility patterns, transfer patterns. And all this is to supplement the work that DEED has done on the employment side. What we launched just last month was developmental education. So now instead of waiting for Getting Prepared 2015, which will be out in March or April, you actually have the data already preloaded into SLEDS. So we know that for the class of 2013, 18% of graduates enrolled in developmental education in their first fall after high school, 18%. They took an average of 5 credits in the fall semester for developmental ed of those who needed developmental ed. Your 18% is 6 percentage points lower than the state average. In addition, we can tell you where they took their developmental education. It's largely at Minscu institutions. We can also tell you what their ACT scores were. So among students needing developmental ed, the average ACT score was 17.5. Compared to students not needing dev ed, it was 24.5, a 7-point difference in ACT composite scores. It kind of gets at the point that we do know who's going to need developmental ed. Also, you can look at the trends over time. So what you see here, and we actually don't... the green line is hidden. So the red line and green lines are the same, so you'll only see two, but there really are three. What you can see is across the graduating classes, Hopkins has been slightly lower than the statewide average in pretty much every year. So that 6 percentage point difference has been picked up across the years. So it's a time trend. So, Madam Chair, that is the very tip of what I can show you that SLEDS can do.
Wow. Well, members, do you have any questions? It was very, very illuminating.
Madam Chair, the other tool is the workforce outcomes tool. I think it would need its own 30 minutes because it's just so awesome. But if you did want to play around with it, you can link to it from that SLEDS research tab. Let's see if it'll load for me. It will. And what it allows you to do, so for the class of 2012, we can look across degree levels, and we can see how many students are working after college.
Ms. Fergus, how have you dealt with the lack of MARS identifying number versus Social Security once they leave our system?
That is a great question, Madam Chair. As you know, K-12 does not collect the Social Security number, but they do collect the MARS number. Workforce data collects the Social Security number, but not a date of birth. Higher ed tends to collect everything. We have first name, last name, date of birth, MARS number, and Social Security number. So we serve to bridge across the data systems. What we actually do is we use what is called probabilistic matching algorithms. It's essentially a formula that looks at what percentage of the information about a person matches between the two systems. And if 91% of that information matches, then we know that we link them and determine that they are the same student. So it's a much more precise type of reporting than we've previously been able to do before.
And where does the funding for this? Are you still getting grant money from the feds, or what's happening with that?
Madam Chair, we are 100% state supported. We are in the OHE budget.
Okay, thank you. So any other questions about the data? Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I encourage members to, on your own, check on your own school districts, compare. Very interesting.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Marilyn Kozier, and I'm the Student Loan Manager for the Office of Higher Education. I'm here today to summarize the results of our report on the feasibility of creating a student loan refinancing program. Since there are connections between a refinancing program and the SELF program, I will discuss the SELF program briefly at the beginning and the end of the presentation. The SELF program was authorized in 1984 and was intended to provide funding to fill the gap between grants and federal loans to cover the cost of attendance. The SELF loan provided a means for students and families to meet their portion of this shared responsibility. The program has served over 250,000 students over the years by providing over $2 billion in loans. Last fiscal year, we originated 9,400 loans totaling $60 million. The program is self-sustaining and operates through our Loan Capital Fund, a fund specifically authorized for student loans, and does not receive any state funding. Tax-exempt and taxable revenue bonds are the funding source, along with the loan repayments. Both variable and fixed-rate loans are available. We charge the same interest rate to all students, and they know the interest rate when they are applying. In contrast, private lenders normally charge different rates based on credit scores, and you won't know your rate until after you've completed the application. We have low default rates, which can be largely attributed to the requirement of a cosigner and payment of interest while in school. The low default rates have benefited the program in terms of keeping our bond costs low. Our gross default rate is less than 7%, and our net rate after collections is less than 2%. In the last legislative session, our office was authorized to offer a student refinancing loan program funded through the Loan Capital Fund, with an individual loan limit of $70,000 and an overall limit of $100 million. Preparing the feasibility report provided us with the opportunity to take a more formal approach and expand on earlier research we did regarding the need for a refinancing program and whether we could offer a program that would be beneficial to borrowers. There are various reasons why individuals are interested in refinancing their student loans: reduce their overall interest costs, reduce their monthly payment, or change the length of time they have to repay their student loans. In 2013 and 14, prior to the refinancing report, we had informal conversations with other states who had or were considering refinancing programs. The information we learned over time is that state refinancing programs are evolving and constantly changing. Other states started refinancing programs because of available funding and an increase in their residents taking out higher interest rate private loans. Initial volume in other states has been relatively low, which has led most of them to utilize their flexibility to modify eligibility criteria and loan characteristics to ensure programs are financially sustainable and yet meet the needs of the borrowers. Within the eight states identified in the report, there have been program expansions, modifications, suspensions, and new programs in development. We recently learned that Iowa's pilot program ended, and they are in the process of evaluating the results in order to determine how to proceed. Other states face the same challenges we do regarding the uncertainty of estimating the demand for refinancing and determining what criteria can make the program successful. Based on the results of our analysis, we believe a refinancing program is feasible for Minnesota. It's tentatively our intent to move forward with a pilot program to be started by the spring of 2016. The amount of time needed to develop a servicing system, negotiate contracts, and generate all the required legal documents will determine when a program could be operational. The goal is for the program to be self-sustaining, independent from the self-loan program. Under current federal tax law, the refinancing loans do not qualify for tax-exempt bonds, so taxable bonds would be needed to fund the refinancing program on an ongoing basis. As indicated earlier, a challenge we face is the uncertainty of demand. Part of the challenge is the number of other refinancing programs in the market, especially since many of those programs may use teaser rates that few people qualify for. Once people find out the actual rate they will receive, they frequently, though, don't start the process over looking for other alternatives. In addition, some programs are highly selective in who they will lend to in terms of which universities borrowers attended, and they may have extremely high income requirements. All lenders do need a high level of prime customers in order to operate a program successfully, especially if you're going to charge uniform rates rather than charging based on credit score. Another challenge relates to the E-Verify requirement for state contracts. Last year, when we renewed our contract with the Credit Bureau, they would not sign a contract for more than a year because of the E-Verify requirement for contracts over $50,000. The Credit Bureau said they could not certify that all the subcontractors they purchased data from would be in compliance with E-Verify. At the current reduced self volume, we can accommodate a contract for $50,000. However, we would need to utilize the Credit Bureau to purchase credit reports for borrowers and co-signers in the refinancing program.
Excuse me, if I could just interrupt you, because I think it's important to put this in a context. Ms. Cozier, is I'm saying it right?
Cozier.
Cozier, I apologize. So last year, the department came forward and said that they believed they could do the refinancing. And they could use the money within the confines of the self-loan program to accomplish that because they were not fully at capacity. And so we were going to just put that in law, but then there was concern around the table, particularly as I remember Senator Lurie was concerned, saying that he wanted to make sure that we could bless the parameters before it started. And so we sent it back basically so that you could come back and tell us before we rolled it out in June, which is what the law said, what exactly you wanted the parameters to be. And so what you're reporting is so dramatically different than that, that I don't want to just, you know, kind of walk forward like this is exactly what we expected. It's very different than how we left it last session. Ms. Cozier?
Madam Chair. Are you speaking in terms of knowing exactly what the parameters are for the program?
No. Last session, there was testimony that you would, in fact, be able to do this refinancing with no uncertainty at all. There was never a question of if that was possible, and that you were going to use the money that was available within the confines of, because you were managing the self-loan program, that there was that money available. And so what you're telling us today is that you can't use that money because of federal laws. I'm not sure, but it's certainly, I don't know if Senator Claussen, you want to make any remarks about what your understanding was at the time?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. No, that's exactly right, and a question I was going to ask as well, because we were under the impression that would be using self-loan funds.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, we would be using funds out of the loan capital fund. When we said we were going to have it separate from the self-loan program, it would come out of our loan capital fund. What we are not looking for is that the self program would, on an ongoing basis, subsidize the refinancing program. We would use money initially from the loan capital fund to fund the program.
So, Ms. Cozier, so then a difference is that you thought they were going to be able to be at the lower tax rate and now it can't be?
Madam Chair, no. We cannot issue tax-exempt bonds for the refinancing. We could issue taxable bonds, and I believe we did indicate that last year also. We can issue taxable bonds, just not the tax-exempt bonds. And right now, we would not foresee issuing any bonds initially, but if this program were to continue and be successful over the long term, we would have to issue taxable bonds.
And Ms. Kosher, why wouldn't you have to issue bonds right now? If you were, because we had said at the end of last session that you were going to begin this program in June.
Madam Chair, we were given, I believe, the authority to start in June. As I believe that's the authority we were given, not necessarily that we could start it as early as June. We just completed the feasibility report last week. So initially, we are looking that we would fund the loans. Again, we have available cash. We would not need to issue bonds immediately. We do have cash available. The timeline we have put out there of spring of 2016 is to allow for the servicing to be set up, negotiate contracts.
Senator Claussen, any questions?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Just to be clear, what is the origin of the loan capital funds?
The loan capital, Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, the loan capital fund goes back several years to when we initially started our self-loan program. We had investments, or we had earnings from the federal student loan program. Years ago, we were a lender under the federal program, and we basically had earnings that we used to initially start the loan, the SELF program. And so the earnings from the SELF program are part of the loan capital fund.
Madam Chair, Ms. Kosher. So over the years, you've kept those separate from the SELF loan funds, which originate from bonding. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, the loan capital fund is kind of our overriding fund that we use for the self-loan program. We also had a smaller GRIP loan program years ago that was also operated out of this loan capital fund. So that's why we would see this refinancing program being operated out of the loan capital fund, the same as the self program.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just can you share with us the amount that's in the loan capital fund at this time?
Ms. Kosher.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, I wouldn't want to speak to that amount off the top of my head. Could we get back to you with that number?
Certainly, yes. Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a different line of questioning, but I'd like to follow up on this. So if I understand, and help me understand this, we can fund the loan capital program through exempt and non-exempt bonds. But in the end, those funds end up in the same pool for lending, and we don't have to differentiate the source of capital in order to fund the loans?
Ms. Kosher.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think you meant to say we fund the self-loan program. We fund the self-loan program out of taxable and tax-exempt bonds. The refinancing, we could not use the tax-exempt bonds under the current federal law.
Senator Pratt.
But thank you, Madam Chair. But the refinance is coming out of the same loan capital fund.
Correct.
And so we don't, and I guess, Madam Chair, if I
Senator
may,
Pratt.
We don't have any, I guess I'm getting confused by the fact that you've got self-loan funds operating under one set of rules and refinancing operating under another set of rules, and those funds being commingled into one funding source.
Ms. Kosher.
Madam Chair, Senator, within the individual bonds that we issue, there are trust accounts established, and that's what, when we issue a bond, we can only use it for certain purposes. And then within that, we do, again, have trust accounts separated for the particular loans and bonds. And with the refinancing loans, we could not issue tax-exempt bonds to fund them. We could issue taxable bonds, or we can use money out of our loan capital fund.
Okay.
Other questions, Senator Pratt, on a different line?
Unless somebody else wants to go, I can say, okay. You know, maybe just a couple of comments, if I may, Madam Chair. Being in financial services, and having a background in risk management, I understand what's going on here, and a couple of things that concern me about this report, and one is the use of teaser rates. Risk-based pricing is a tool that's used by private institutions to offset the default risk that comes with making a loan. And the teaser rates, to me, Ms. Kozier, seem to indicate a bias that there's some sort of UDAP, unfair, deceptive, abusive advertising practices going on. And that's not the case at all. These rates, there's a suite of rates available based on default risk, and the bank and the investors have to take that default risk, where I believe you're asking the state and Minnesota taxpayers to cover any sort of default risk that's coming that comes from these loans. And so I guess there's an unfair advantage or an unfair playing field here as we talk about this, because certainly standard banking practices, standard risk management are, I think, being put in a very pejorative light. And that's not the case at all, because banks are held to an OCC standard of safety and soundness loan practices that they have to meet. And so I just want to be careful as we look at teaser rates and the fact that few people qualify isn't the case. These are not unfair, deceptive, or abusive advertising practices that are going on, and that this risk-based pricing using the FICO score, using proprietary scores based on your own on a lending institution's own experience is not discriminatory. But they have to cover. What it says is that each cohort, each group in that predictive model has to cover their default risk. And so maybe I'll stop there before I ask my question if there's any.
Well, Senator Pratt, could you explain to the rest of the committee what teaser rates mean?
Well, typically teaser rates are rates that are advertised to bring people in, and then they're used to switch out for a higher rate. Again, as Ms. Kozier said, where very few people tend to qualify, and those are considered unfair, deceptive, and abusive advertising practices, which both the OCC and the CFPB have done put a lot of effort to cracking down on, and a number of lending institutions have done that. The fact that you've got differentiated pricing is not necessarily a teaser rate. And I think that's the concern I have is as we're looking at this report, it seems to be drawing a conclusion that when you look at it from an industry standpoint, isn't necessarily apples to apples. And so I just want to make sure that the committee understands that while Ms. Kozier is right, what we have to understand is that where a bank is having to differentiate their pricing based on default risk, this loan program seems to put that risk on Minnesota taxpayers. And if that's something we're okay with, that's fine. But to suggest that there are widespread practices of unfair, deceptive advertising practices going on, I would have to disagree.
Ms. Kozier?
Madam Chair, Senator, I appreciate your comment. I think we were taking it more in terms of what we've heard from students in that they don't know what the interest rate is when they're applying for the loan, and they see the lowest interest rate, which is what they advertise, and they may think they're going to qualify for it, but they do not qualify for that rate. Also, for clarification purposes, this program is not funded through the general fund. It is a self-sustaining program.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. I don't mean to dominate the conversation, Madam Chair. So I guess are these considered asset-based securities, and do the investors understand the risk of loss associated with them, or how do you provision for losses in this portfolio?
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, Senator, we do have a bad debt reserve that we have to set aside in accordance with our accounting requirements that is there to absorb the losses. But the bad debt reserve is, again, funded through the loan capital fund.
Is this different than you?
Thank you. That helps.
Okay. You want to continue?
Madam Chair. I was talking about the E-Verify requirements that are currently in law regarding the contracts and the difficulty we've had with the credit union or credit bureau not being willing to sign the contract. And most lenders do purchase credit lists as a targeted marketing approach directed at people with student loan debt. So the contracting limitation would restrict our ability to utilize the credit bureau for marketing purposes and potentially for basic operations depending upon the combined volume of self and refinancing loans. We've identified some probable eligibility criteria for the pilot program, including that the person would be a Minnesota resident at the time of refinancing or a current self borrower, earned a degree or certificate, a minimum FICO credit score and maximum debt-to-income ratio would be established. And if those criteria aren't met, a cosigner would be required. We're also looking at having a cosigner release option. Other probable characteristics, again, we would look at the variable and fixed rate options, a borrower choice of 5, 10, and 15-year terms with different interest rates based on the term, minimum loans of $10,000, and the maximum by law is the $70,000. We were looking at a lower amount of $25,000 for people earning an associate or certificate. We look at being able to refinance private loans, some federal loans, and self loans. The Parent Plus loan would not be included in the pilot at this time. In preparing the report, we also looked at how the current self program fits in with the need to refinance. The SELF program offers low interest rates to students while they are in school, and we are able to offer the lower interest rates in part, again, because of our ability to utilize tax-exempt bond funding. In 2006, the repayment terms were restructured in order to have it operate more like a consolidation program, with the length of the repayment term extended as the borrower took out additional loans. Opportunities were identified in the report that could restore the value to the SELF program. It would be optimal to provide the lower cost interest rate while the student is in school rather than needing to take out higher interest rate loans during school and refinancing later at a lower rate. And increasing the SELF loan limits is a potential option. In addition, our office continues to work with a coalition of other state loan programs to change federal law, which restricts the ability of institutions to provide information to students and families about state loan programs, including the SELF loan, unless the institutions go through a preferred lender process. Madam Chair and members, that concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time today.
So when was it? 2012.
So, Ms. Kozier, at the time when Senator Claussen put forward his bill, we were doing this really at the recommendation of the Office of Higher Education as one of the solutions for the very high interest rates that students were carrying and the fact that the feds were not being very helpful in terms of lowering those costs. And so we knew that the SELF loan was a really great opportunity for students, but that federal law prohibited you from being able to market the SELF loan. And so this was an alternative that really came forward as a recommendation from the Office of Higher Ed. Hearing some of the parameters that you're recommending and that this would take another year, which we're a little bit surprised because we were ready to go, we thought, last year, and we stalled it because of some committee members' concerns, but certainly not concerns on behalf of the Office of Higher Ed. So now, reading through the lines and hearing all this, do you still think this is a good approach, or do you think that we would be smarter to try and do all we can to alleviate the SELF loan constraints?
Madam Chair, well, we do think it's important to look at the SELF loan constraints, but in addition, we want to address the debt that's already out there that students already have, that it's too late for them at this point to take out the SELF loan. So we do see that the refinancing is an option to help people who already have taken out the private loan. So I think it can be a dual-track approach.
And what do you predict the interest rate, and maybe Senator Pratt's a better person to ask, but what do you predict the interest rate to come in at?
Madam Chair, we're currently looking at, again, fixed and variable rate options with three different terms, the 5, 10, and 15-year terms. And again, the interest rates that we're looking at that I would present today would be in today's environment. You know, again, once we roll out the program, the economy can be different. We were looking at variable rate ranges of 3.1% to 4.2%. Again, that would depend on the term that the student or the borrower selected. We were looking at fixed rate ranges of 4 to 7%.
Thank you. Senator Claussen, do you have any more questions on that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you compare that to rates that are out in the public market, the rates that you just quoted?
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen. Again, with our approach, we're looking at this time not doing the credit-based, so we were looking at only the differentiation in interest will be dependent upon whether they select the fixed or variable and the time frame. So in the report we prepared, there's different ranges of variable rates. We were seeing as low as 2.17% all the way up to 8.75% in some other private lenders, variable rates of 3.5% to 12.29%.
So it might help some and not others.
Senator Sharon and then Senator Franzen.
That was my question, too. So the rates that you're describing now, is what you're able to develop at the rates that you're establishing through the self-loan refinancing program may not really help the students reduce their debt substantially. Am I hearing you correctly?
Ms. Rocher.
You know, we go through this process, is going to achieve the objective, which was the initial goal, which is to reduce the burden in this way of people who have already taken out loans at very high interest rate and are having difficulty paying them back. We're doing this in order to sort of create some savings for them at our risk, but it doesn't sound like that's necessarily going to happen.
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, Senator, well, looking at what we've heard from other states that have offered refinancing programs is they're seeing loans 14.5% interest rates into a refinancing. So if they can get into an interest rate of 3.1 to 4.2% or 4 to 7%, that is much lower than a 14% loan that they might have right now. So we do believe that the interest rates we can offer can help people who already have higher interest rates.
I guess I misunderstood then what you said before. When Senator Claussen said, what is the range right now of the interest rate on student loans? You're saying it's other states it's 14%, but let's see, how do I articulate this? We'd like to know who of those who would be eligible for this program. What is the range of their current interest rates on their loans right now as compared to what we're going to be able to offer under this program? Because it doesn't seem, at least based on what I thought you said, that it sounds very much different and may not create much cost savings for the work that's going to go in trying to produce this program.
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, Senator, well, when we look at interest rates out in the market, we see fixed rates that are up over 12%, 12 and 13%. We're looking at potentially rates of 4 to 7%, so that is quite a bit lower. Variable rates we see out in the market, again, over 9%. We're talking about variable ranges of 3.1 to 4.2%. So
it's clear. Thank you.
And members, remember that a lot of times they don't begin to pay these loans off till they're done, and so these loans were taken out in a much different economic climate than we are today. And so that is why there's the gap and why we would have this opportunity. Senator Franzen.
Thank Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Kozier. Just a quick question about not necessarily this part of the eligibility of refinancing, but just to clarify, only students that are U.S. citizens, non-U.S. citizens, or international students don't currently qualify for even getting loans under this program. Just want to clarify that.
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, Senator. No, an international student can take out a self-loan under this current program. They do require a U.S. citizen or permanent resident as a co-signer.
Just to clarify that a little. So non-U.S. citizens as well, for instance, students that are under the DREAM Act here, would they qualify for this? Because I know they currently, my assumption was that they wouldn't qualify for self-loans.
Madam Chair, Senator, are you asking if they would qualify for the refinancing or for the self-loan program?
For both.
For the self-loan program, again, they do not need to be a U.S. citizen. They just need the co-signer. For the refinancing program, our requirement was a Minnesota resident or a current self-borrow.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Madam Chair, let me just put on the record, I'm not opposed to refinancing. I mean, shoot, you can refinance a car, you can refinance a mortgage. So I'm not at all opposed to the program. But I'm looking at the rates and prime at 3.25. Is this 3.1% on top of an index, or is this a fully loaded? And what are you using as an index for your variable rate?
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, Senator, the range, as I stated, would be the final rate. We would be looking at using the LIBOR rate and then adding a margin to cover the cost. So the ranges, though, are the final rate to the consumers.
Same as the Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so how does this... how does this rate compare to your expected loss rate?
Ms. Kozier.
Madam Chair, Senator, at this point I couldn't tell you what our loss rate. We only have the basis of what we have in our current program. You know, our default rates, which I had indicated, were less than 7% gross and 2% net.
Okay. And we do want to wrap it up because we have a half hour and we have three more reports. So, quick question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think when we first started this, we were looking at taking students that have got the high rates. We heard testimony, I think, of 13-14% in some cases. And I think as I look at this, we're going to accomplish at least my goal originally to get down to interest rates that are going to be saving students a considerable amount of money. So I appreciate all the work that you put into this. I would hope that we can speed up the process so we can get this out to students as soon as possible. And again, thank you for your work.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, Warren.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Members, next we will have Megan Fitzgibbon present on the Greater Minnesota Internship Tax Credit.
Thank you. Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Megan Fitzgibbon. I'm the manager of scholarship programs at the office, and I'm going to be covering the Greater Minnesota Internship Tax Credit Program today. The program was established in law in the 2013 legislative session, but didn't go into effect until the 2014 tax year, so last year was the first year it was implemented. Again, it's a program that is designed to help Greater Minnesota employers enter into agreements with college campuses to help employ students as interns. Greater Minnesota, as you can see on your materials, is defined as any county outside of the, I think it's the 11-county metro area, as opposed to the 7-county metro area. Employers who enter into these agreements can apply for tax credits up to $2,000 per student intern, and that is based on 40% of the amount of the compensation they pay to that student. Eligible student interns are supposed to earn academic credit or some kind of other, fulfill some kind of requirement after successfully completing the internship. Again, students must be participating or must be attending one of the participating Minnesota colleges. The college campuses that can participate include public institutions and all nonprofit private institutions that have baccalaureate degrees or graduate degrees. The student also has to have completed at least 50% of their program. Employers have to be, again, a Minnesota taxpayer, and they have to employ a student at a location in Greater Minnesota. And they do have to agree to pay the student at least minimum wage to work a minimum of 16 hours for 8 weeks. At least. Last year, or in 2014, although we had available to us something like 2,000 tax credits at up to 2,000 apiece, it ended up being a total of 9. And I'll talk a little bit about why there's such a low usage in a second. But that's a little under, or 18,000. Actual usage won't be clear until after these employers actually apply for their tax credits in their 2014 tax returns. That included 7 employers in Greater Minnesota. There technically was 10 students involved, but one student didn't successfully complete the internship. And there were 29 campuses that agreed to participate, but these students were only attending 5 of those 29. So far this year, as of last week, there were 14 participating colleges, and I've already heard of a couple of internships being set up, but those haven't started yet. So again, you can tell there's low usage as compared to how many tax credits are available. There are statutory barriers that make it very difficult for schools to participate, students to participate, and employers who want to participate. The first is that the statute that governs this says that schools have to award academic credit to the student, but yet the student can't be participating in the internship to fulfill a requirement that's part of their academic program, which sounds kind of illogical, but that's the way the statute ended up. So that's one thing that makes it really difficult. My understanding from the people who were involved in the crafting of the legislation was there was some desire to want to have this be part of new internship relationships, and they didn't want it to include like clinicals or practicums that might be part of a nursing degree or something along those lines. So they wrote that in, but didn't really necessarily understand what the implications would be. The second statutory barrier that has come up over the last year, and what I've heard anecdotally from several employers, is that employers do have to agree to say that they would not have hired the student but for the tax credit. They are already saying that this is not, you know, replacing an employee, that they're going to pay this person, that they, you know, expect and want to hire this person later on. But the $2,000 to many employers is not a sufficient amount of a incentive to say they wouldn't have necessarily hired the intern in the first place. There's other barriers that are outside of the statute that also limit usage. The school is required to provide academic credit to the student, but that also means that the student is usually charged for that academic credit. So even if they might be working, they're in some cases not going to make enough to pay for the credits that they have to pay for. If they're going to school in the summer, they may have already utilized all their financial aid. So, again, the school has to award academic credit, but in some cases the student's going to have to pay for that. There are some institutions that provide no credit internships, or they have other means that they cover this cost for students, but in a lot of cases that's not necessarily the situation. Another barrier that's come up is that in some cases employers do hire interns, but they pay them a stipend. They don't necessarily hire them as employees, and they don't pay them the same way that they would kind of come up as an employee on their taxes. And so that's come up in a couple of cases as well. And that concludes my testimony today about the Greater Minnesota Internship Tax Credit Program. I'm looking forward to hopefully having a more usage this year, but we'll see how that goes.
Well, thank you very much for the report. I think we can hear that there should be, if this does go forward, there should be changes to the language. And just one quick question, because I know that we do have 2 other reports we need to get through, but we will not move forward with this program, hopefully, although it does go through the tax area, so we don't have that much control. But do you feel as though, I remember at the time, Ms. Grimes had recommended this be a grant program, not a tax back-end mm-hmm. kind of subsidy?
Madam Chair, members, that in fact, a lot of the language that is the statute language now comes from North Dakota, that where the program is actually a grant program. And so in our agency, this is, like you said, it's something that is actually in conjunction with the Department of Revenue, and we don't have any experience, you know, allocating tax credits to employers and working with schools. And so it's very, it's for us, technically, we have, you know, we would have agreed to maybe, you know, and not opposed a grant program at the time. However, this is how it came out, and this is what we've been doing.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did carry similar legislation in 2011, and at that time, I think it was a grant program. I do think the idea or the concept is an important one.
Yeah.
And what I have found talking to employers is once those interns have the opportunity to participate or work intern at those employers, that many times that leads to full-time employment. So I think it's a good concept, a good idea, but clearly we need to work on it a little bit to improve the program or come up with a better idea. So I'm interested in working together with the department and certainly the committee on trying to do that. I'm not sure who carried it in 2013, but we'll work.
Senator Eakin. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we'll work with them.
And Madam Chair, it is within the Office of Higher Ed statutes, the program, so it definitely is something that could come in under the Higher Ed Committee, at least in my opinion, because it's within our statutes as opposed to, there are pieces of it in revenue statutes, but it's in ours too.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
All right, moving on. Again, my name is Maren Henderson, and I will be presenting on the study abroad law that was passed in 2014. I will point your attention to the full report, especially given time. Just wanted to make sure that you saw that you do have the full report. But this came out of the law. So there were two requirements. The first was in Section 5, which asked both institutions to report incidents of hospitalization and death that occurred on their study abroad programs. And the other reporting is through the Secretary of State and the Office of Higher Education. And the language around sexual assault and crime reporting is that we are to report the best available information. It was very clear that this information does not come from the institutions, but is to come from the best available information. And I'll get into more detail, but just so you know, that would be coming from the Department of Justice and the Department of State's information that they collect. And then the other section that applied to study abroad was Section 14, which asked the Office of Higher Education to assess appropriate regulation of study abroad. And it included a request that this balance protecting students while maintaining their opportunity to participate. And so as a result, that is the report you have in front of you, is this assessment of appropriate regulation. For a little context, roughly two-thirds of Minnesota students who study abroad do attend 7 of the largest institutions that are offering study abroad programming. What we don't know much about is the 3,000 or so students who are studying abroad from institutions that are not in the top 7. And I give this as context because this is largely what we hope to accomplish when we have the data that will be collected over this academic year. I should also note that only institutions who report to the Institute of International Education are included in this graph. We don't know the number of institutions from Minnesota that are not included who are sending students or providing credit for students going abroad. We will know that next year. So the first section of our report sort of laid out the implementation process that OHI pursued over the last year. We've met many, many times with key stakeholders who are involved in this issue. So first is the Secretary of State's office, who are included in the legislation as key actors in this. And then also ClearCause Foundation, which is an advocacy group of parents who have lost their children due to incidents that occurred while they were studying abroad. They've been key partners in our implementation of this law. We've also worked extensively with post-secondary institutions and specifically study abroad professionals who work at post-secondary institutions. And then what's known in the field as third-party providers, so corporations or organizations that schools contract with to carry out their study abroad programs. And then just the timeline, we've been working over the summer and through the fall on this implementation plan. The reporting period began on August 1st of this year. So right now, schools are all collecting data on their students and the incidents that may occur abroad. The reporting period ends on July 31st of the summer. Our report was due, as you see, on February 1st. And we point this out because, again, we don't yet have the data that needed to be collected for the first year. The schools must report to our office, by law, their incidents by November 1st. But because the law requires us to publish this information by institution and we have FERPA guidelines to uphold, it's going to take some administrative time to prepare those reports for our website. So we expect that the reports will be available no later than January 1st of 2016. In the interest of time, I won't go into too much depth over these questions. They are in your report on pages 10 through 14, has a more thorough explanation of how we answered these questions. But these were discussions that were raised with the stakeholders, and our biggest interest as an office, I would say, is to make sure that institutions across the state are reporting information in the same way. Because what we're really hoping for is consumer data that families and parents and students can use to compare programs and opportunities. And so the one thing I wanted to point out on this issue is the flowchart, which is included as Appendix C in your report. And this is what we will be providing to institutions to help make sure that there is standard data reported. A few other things on these questions. The first is this question of who is included in an institution's report. This was not specifically clarified in the law. And so as an office and working with groups, we determined that a student's home institution should be responsible for their reporting. This means, however, that hypothetically a student could regularly attend Augsburg but go on a University of Minnesota program. They would be reported by Augsburg, not the University of Minnesota. Where this comes into play and may become challenging is cross-state interpretation. So if a student typically enrolls at the University of Wisconsin-Madison but is attending a Minnesota program, they would not be reported and captured in this data set because their home institution is the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's also important to note that residency is not included. So a student could be from Minnesota and attend a Minnesota program, but if their home institution is out of state, they cannot be captured. We explored other options, but there was no other way that we could determine to do it without risking double counting. Another issue was, how do we define study abroad program? And what we found in this learning about this field is that there's program types, and there are program hosts, and there are program countries, and it became unclear, especially to professionals in the field, what we meant by the word program. For purposes of this data year, we determined that program, country, and type would be the most relevant to consumers. However, we have heard that program name and program host are also important, so we'll be working with that. And you'll notice that we included it as a recommendation to clarify that language that we'll get to later. Another issue raised was, how does an institution know about an incident? We have a section on defining institutional knowledge. But again, just to keep in mind, the part of the challenge of having the report come from the institution is that the institution then must know of the incident. But oftentimes, students are going abroad with organizations that are not their home institution, or they are going independently on an internship or independent research. Therefore, another one of our recommendations relates to that knowledge sharing. And then I already discussed crimes and sexual assaults. I'm happy to answer questions about that. But in the interest of time, we'll move on to how the institution reports will look on our website. So these,
And maybe because we do have the other report, if you want to just go to the recommendations.
Sure. Thanks, Madam Chair. So our main recommendation is to wait for the data to come in before making drastic changes to this legislation, to let us use the data to inform future policy changes. In the meantime, we would strongly recommend assembling a broad-based working group. We found that one of the biggest benefits of the way that this has all played out this summer and fall was working with both institutions, third-party providers, as well as advocacy groups and individuals concerned about student safety and making sure that everyone is at the table. Some possible regulations that the legislature could explore would have to do essentially with setting a bottom baseline expectation for all institutions. So from our research, we have found that many Minnesota institutions already have all of these things in place. The missing information has to do with those that one-third of Minnesota students where we just don't know that much about the types of programs that they're going on. And so the bottom baseline expectations, which are really based in research-based best practices in this field, are setting policies and procedures, having training for faculty-led programs, and then requirements for student participation, things like orientation and insurance. And then, as I mentioned earlier, some statute changes could, one, be to address this concern of institutional knowledge. So the law could be changed to more clearly require institutions to request, but not mandate, incident disclosure upon a student's return to their institution. And then another clarification deals with that question of what do we really mean by program and what information do we want collected from the institution.
Thank you very much, Ms. Henderson. And we have taken your recommendations, and we will come back with a bill that will reflect just the basics. I think we would concur that we ought to wait for the data to do much else. I believe Julie Struthers from the Secretary of State's office maybe here. She has also recommended a change. Is Julie here? Very good. Gonna just come forward. She has recommended one change with regard to the section pertaining to sexual assaults. So, Ms. Struthers?
Julie Struthers with the Office of the Secretary of State. We were brought into this whole process sort of at the end as a place to house the information. And in looking at the bill and working with the folks at the Department of Higher Ed, it's in Subdivision 3. There's a piece that talks about the Secretary of State publishing on its website the best available information by country on sexual assaults. And we've had a lot of discussions with the different groups that attempt to collect this information and get a handle on if there's anything out there. And we are interested in a tweak to this language just to make sure that it's clear that we're not putting together a report that's a reflection of what the Secretary of State's office thinks is the best information, but just gathering the resources for folks to look at. Because in talking to a couple of nonprofits that do this work and are trying to collect this work, they're struggling to come together with the best available information. I think the Center on Foreign Exchange, I'm blanking on their name, but they're putting out a report in March this year that will have some of this information. But my understanding is it won't be by country, it'll be by region. And it only encompasses about 30 universities, which is an incredibly small sample size. So we are mostly interested in a tweak to this language so that we're putting forward resources for folks and gathering all the resources that are out there. But it's not the Secretary of State's office putting together our own report on what's happening country by country. We don't have the resources in our office to do that. We have a concern that it would be misleading to folks because of just the limited information that's out there.
Thank you, Ms. Struthers. And I've seen your recommendation, and we will present it to the committee. It makes good sense. We appreciate it. Very good. Well, thank you, Ms. Henderson, for that excellent work and the excellent report. We appreciate it. Now your final report.
Retention and completion.
So we complete with retention and completion.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Sean Williams-Weich, and I am a researcher at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. and I am here to talk to you about our report called A Discussion on Retention and Completion. And by 2020, it's been estimated that 74% of jobs in Minnesota will require some form of education or training beyond high school. Minnesota's economic future will rely on a diverse, skilled, educated workforce, implying that we cannot afford to tolerate the staggering inequities in post-secondary access and completion. Simply put, a robust economy relies on a steady supply of talent, educated graduates ready to meet the needs of a dynamic, knowledge-based 21st century economy. With that said, Minnesota's high levels of educational attainment, its professional economy, and its quality of life are at risk if we do not improve retention and completion for three key groups: lower-income students, students of color, and low-wage working adults. As you all know, Minnesota has historically had a high level of educational attainment. In 2012, Minnesota led the nation in the proportion of its adult population with at least some college or above, around 70%. Significant disparities, though, exist in educational attainment by race and ethnicity. Only 29% of black adults and 23% of Hispanic adults have attained an associate degree or higher, as compared to 45% of white adults. In addition, with that in mind, students of color enrollments in post-secondary education have doubled from 2003 to 2012. Also, enrollments of older students have increased by over a third over the same time period as compared to 8% growth for students aged 25 and younger. And also, we should note that Minnesota has done a good job when it comes to access to post-secondary education. That can be seen in the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities System's mission, which is to provide access to post-secondary education to anyone that seeks it, and also in the Minnesota State Grant, which has allowed many more lower-income Minnesotans to be able to afford post-secondary education. However, this still leaves completion fully out of the equation. Simply stated, access without completion is not affordable for both the student and for the state. This has led us to design a renewed social compact that addresses how students can better be helped in Minnesota with completing their desired programs. And the first point is taking responsibility for increasing completion rates at all institutions. Schools with admission standards accept students if they believe they are capable of completing a program at the institution. As a result, they have a responsibility of seeing that the student completes their desired program. Open access institutions face a greater challenge in the responsibility of seeing that students complete, however, based on the cohort characteristics of the student body at the institution. Second, committing to solving and investing in these problems with urgency and collaboration. Leaders from all fields, public and private, and nonprofit, must come together to renew a student-centered commitment to the state's future. Expanded and frequent partnerships with businesses and the nonprofit community must be needed to leverage their resources to maximize the state's return on investment in higher education. Third, use transformational research both in state policymaking and at post-secondary institutions to inform policies and practices. Both at the state level and at institutions, policies must be grounded in research before and after implementation. A focus must be on effectiveness, efficiency, scalability, and sustainability. And transformational research is simply research that leads to transformational change. Transformational change is a set of actions fundamentally different from what has been done prior. Fourth, embrace the diversity within Minnesota's higher education system. All institutions in the state deserve support to maximize their different missions to best serve their students. A homogeneous plan for a heterogeneous student population will not maximize Minnesota's potential for future success. Fifth, invest funds strategically. Investments of public resources should focus on access, retention, and completion for Minnesota students. And finally, supporting institutional culture change. Changes to improve retention and completion rates will not be easy. In order for any strategy to be successful, Leaders, faculty, and staff across campuses need to be fully committed to improving completion and creating a culture of completion on their campuses. All members of the campus community must buy in to the notion that college completion is of utmost importance. And now I'll provide a collection of best practice strategies that have been shown to boost retention and completion rates at post-secondary institutions. But in the interest of time, I will go through the broad categories that each of the strategies are placed under. All of the strategies are explained in detail in the report, along with examples that are currently being used in Minnesota, where applicable. The following strategies are also not meant to be prescriptive, nor each one will be applicable to every institution. Rather, these are a collection of best practices that have been implemented across a range of institutions. Individual institutions must decide which practices would be the most beneficial for their specific populations. And these categories are social and campus integration, academic policies that promote completion, alternative pathways to completion, and affordability. So with social and campus integration, successful social integration into a college environment is necessary for students to be able to complete their post-secondary education. Social integration requires a sense of belonging on campus, which is fostered by the informal connections created with peers and faculty outside of the classroom. Students can improve their social and communication skills and feel more engaged in a positive campus culture. Academic policies that promote completion. Academic success is one of the strongest factors in predicting whether or not a student will complete their post-secondary education. GPA, both in high school and during college, is one such predictive factor. However, research suggests that retention programs that focus primarily on helping students master course content alone may only address immediate rather than longer-term deficiencies. Students who master course content but fail to develop adequate academic self-confidence, academic goals, institutional commitment, achievement motivation, and social support and involvement may still be at risk of dropping out. Alternative pathways to completion. Some students experience barriers to participating in education due to the current brick-and-mortar model of higher education. Students of color, first-generation college students, low-income students, and students over the age of 24 enroll and graduate college at lower rates than their peers in traditional higher education settings. In addition, more and more students are coming to post-secondary institutions with training acquired from previous jobs, corporate training, the military, and self-guided study. This gives these students the potential to save time and money while earning their degree or credential. Higher education could be a reality for more if we better identify the needs of varying student populations and offer alternative pathways to a college degree, especially for certain populations such as students with full-time jobs, adult students returning to higher education, workers seeking additional training, and students with family obligations. Finally, affordability. For students failing to complete their desired degree or credential, higher education is never affordable. Facing a slow recovery from the recent economic recession, states including Minnesota are grappling with affordability, access, and completion. With limited resources, Minnesota should increasingly target funding to programs with demonstrated results, and more specifically, the most cost-effective of these programs. Even among financial aid programs, with no effect on initial enrollment, financial aid can impact persistence and completion. Adequate financial aid is cited most often by both lower-income students and students of color as critical in their continued progress toward a college degree. Students face sacrifices that come with enrolling and persisting in higher education in the form of lost wages, lost family time, and less advancement in an existing job that will need to be reflected in aid levels. And that completes my presentation, Madam Chair.
Dr. Williams-Wick, is that right?
White,
thank you. I apologize. Excellent, excellent report. Would you expect that we would see the policies that are within this report in the governor's policy recommendations?
Madam Chair, I'd have to defer to the commissioner on that question.
Okay. I can tell you that members around this table are working hard on policies that actually are consistent and reflective of this. I think that we have an excellent opportunity to partner with you to implement some of these things that you have put forward. I think it's wonderful to see these kinds of recommendations and recognition of what it would, because it is a transformational approach to what's happening currently. Do you have any thoughts about how it would be best to scale this?
Madam Chair, it would depend on the program and the type of institution that a program would be implemented in. Like I said earlier, not all these programs work across universally across every campus in the state. It's going to take institutions to determine which programs will work at their campuses based on the specific populations they have at those campuses. And the scale of those programs would then also be determined by the size of their student bodies.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for your report. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is a good report. I really appreciate all the graphs that I've been looking through as you've been speaking. And I think there's one page that I'd like to make sure that all the committees get a chance to look at, and that's page 8. I think that graph should be seared in our minds. It's really a tragedy that less than 50% of Minnesota students who take the ACT are ready for college. And that is only of the students who take the test. Think about all the students who graduate from high school who don't take the test. And so I see that a lot of our issues that we're trying to resolve in higher ed are in the K-12 system. And so it's certainly a unified system in that we're dealing with students all the way through. But I think Minnesota has to take a really hard look at the fact that we have such a high achievement gap and so few of our students are graduating ready for college. That is not sustainable for us as a state. And I think this is a sad graph for us to look at today.
Thank you. Very good. Any other comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you very much. And with that, before I adjourn, I do want to remind members that next, the 10th of February, which is next Tuesday, we will be meeting in a joint committee on higher education to select our region candidates, and that will be at 245 in room 5 of the state office building. We had said it was going to be at 4. We are wondering, and so if we get feedback that it doesn't work, the reason why we moved it to 245 is because that is when the House committee start time is, and given we're no longer meeting during that time as a committee, we figured that committee members had that time available. And so that we could do it in the afternoon was our first choice. If we hear significant problems, we'll respect the time we had originally chosen. So 245. February 10th, room 5 of the State Office Building. Very good. And with that, committee is adjourned.